Anybody here at the back? That's sort of not.
Keep going.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I need. Okay. Well, thank you all for your patience, and thank you for the noble efforts of the Zendo team there to do something that they've probably never done before, exactly this way. Through the miracle of technology, we are able to welcome our good Dharma friend, Kuen Maria Butterworth, to speak today. Maria's a longtime member of Calgary Soto Zen. She probably would have been out here practicing with us at Zoom at Loon Lake sooner if it weren't for the pandemic. Maria has been a registered nurse for 15 years, working mostly in end-of-life care and geriatric care, which means during the pandemic, long-term care. She's also worked in oncology and hematology. And a big part of her practice in life has been parenting for, am I right, 4 now adult children? For 29 years. So there will be, I think, time for some Q&A afterwards. So Maria, please go ahead. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Kate. Can everybody hear me? I'm audible. Yes, good. So thanks for your patience and generosity at the outset. I'm very excited to have been invited and very honored, and also, of course, a little bit nervous. I'm going to be talking about my life as an RN and parent, which for me is more or less the same somehow. But I'd like to start by invoking Richard Wagamese and doing a little reading from him. He is an Ojibwe indigenous person and a prolific author and a spokesperson for his people. My people say that we are all one song. We are born of the same spiritual energy. We are created in its image and we carry it within us. As we walk upon the earth, we move with the same eternal rhythm that beats within it, the heartbeat. The earth is a drum, a spiritual being, and the beat of its first sound we hear in the darkness of our mother's belly. The drum of her, the heartbeat. It comforts, consoles, nurtures, and protects us as we form and as we learn to listen for that sound in the darkness. When we are born and we come out into this reality to find our identity, the first thing we do is cry. We cry at the sudden separation from that heartbeat. Our spirit journey on the planet is to seek reunion with that heartbeat. That's why drums were the first instruments developed by cultures around the world. All of us seek a reconnection to that same eternal spiritual heartbeat. All of us seek a reconnection to creative, nurturing spiritual energy. All of us carry that yearning, and we created ceremony and ritual and religions out of that ache. So the truth is that we have always been one song. I would like to dedicate whatever merit and virtue comes from what I'm doing to the healing of his spirit and his people. I also think he really got me when he spoke about the ache and the ache to be connected. That's certainly that's always driven my practice. And it's also, I think, what motivated me to become both an RN and a parent. just the richness of intimate, meaningful relationship. The other influence that on me at the moment is the Tenzo Kyokan, How to Cook Your Life by Dogen. One of my favorite sayings from that is, seeking mind of a Tenzo is actualized by rolling up your sleeves. That's the other thing I really love about both parenting and nursing, is you get to do stuff. You get to just really roll up your sleeves and get at it and do. So the way I'm going to present this is kind of a snapshot. On the parenting front, my first, I would say almost enlightening experience, awakening for sure, was during labor. It was my first baby. It would hurt like heck. And as you know, labor is a coming and going of contractions. So in between, you have lots of time to think about what's coming next. And I was getting into a super panic because every time a contraction came and it got worse and worse, I knew there was going to be a lot of pain. And I really was starting to lose it. That's probably the closest time, I think, that I had an experience of losing my sanity because I thought, no, it's coming again. It's pain. And then this angel nurse, the midwife, came to me and said, look at me. I looked her in the eyes and she said, breathe. And she breathed with me. In, out. Just now, just this in and out. Pain in the background. Going to a climax, abating to in between. And this healing, centering action of just focusing on the breath is something that has just stuck with me for, it just took me totally out of the panic. It made it all completely doable. It made it possible to, despite the force, the immense pressure of the contractions, to get out of the way. That's the other lesson I learned from that experience, to get out of the way of nature doing its thing. Because of course the impulse is to resist. No, despite all the pressure, despite all the force being brought upon me, to get out of the way, to relax the muscles, to stay with the breath, to just be in that ongoing moment, has been one of the main insights of my life. And then of course the babies are born and they want all sorts of things. And you lose all sorts of sleep because now it's no longer about me. It's about somebody else. The other huge lesson of my life, learning how to bring some perspective to my own needs, so that I can get past them to attend to the needs of my children. I'm still working on that one. I practiced nursing in Kuwait for a number of years as a school nurse, which was a total cultural experience. I think the main lesson there I learned is one day a child came in. He must have been, I don't know, 12-ish, 10 to 12 in that range. And he said, Miss, they speak very respectfully over there. He said, Miss, why do people get sick? And I started talking about, well, you know, there's germs and viruses and, you know, and then the body does this thing to try and get rid of them. And he said, no, that's not what I want to know. Why do we get sick? And I said, well, the body is not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily strong enough to fight them. This is not what I want to know. Why does God allow us to get sick? And for me, it was such a beautiful moment of someone asking from the heart, you know, in all innocence and full of childlike curiosity, this expression of a culture of spirituality, a kind of spirituality, which living in a kind of secular society culture now, I just thought was beautiful, that there is still, or maybe it's a, that there is a possibility for a cultural mindset that other than completely materialistic and unspiritual. I loved that moment. I really, really enjoyed it. The other thing about living in Kuwait was being a minority, not being the dominant, being of the dominant, powerful culture. I highly recommend the experience. And then very most recently, so I did do nursing in Kuwait, but I took quite a while out from my nursing job to be a parent. And so I lost my RN status and I had to get it. I had to do some work to get it back. And when I did get it back in 2016-ish, I started working as an at-home end-of-life RN. So I don't know if this is the case in other parts of Canada, but in Alberta, everybody's can have 72 hours of at-home end-of-life care from an RN. And that's the job I did. So it's not so much palliative, but actually the last 72 hours. So either people will go to hospice, they're waiting for a hospice placement, or they want to die at home. 12-hour shifts, either days or nights. Having only one person really to focus on. The family, of course, is huge. And it was a lot like a sort of speed dating. Yeah, to go, come in there, really get the lay of, you know, the where people were at, what they wanted in this very, very intense, crucial part of their life's experience, both from the patient's point of view and the family's point of view, and to try to be of some kind of help. My big takeaway from that was how, you know, and from practice point of view, how to get out of the, how to get me out of the way of being able to be maximally of service, to really take in the needs and the intentions and the wants of my clients and just allow myself to be a conduit, whatever I had to offer to let that, to bring that into the situation rather than my own needs, you know, my own fears, my own agendas. Incredible practice Dharmagate for that. Because of course, there's a lot of emotion. It's very hard to not put barriers up to protect yourself. Of course, you got to do what you got to do for your own sanity, but the real art of working in that setting is to be open so that I can respond most effectively. And so, you know, so whatever they want, even if I don't necessarily agree with what they want, to try and facilitate it. And I found it's been a while now since I've done it, so nothing really pops to mind in the moment, but to really just be fully open under difficult conditions. Yeah, that was my, I think, the biggest skill and takeaway that I think that might make sense in terms of Buddhist practice as well. And often people would ask me, you know, what should I do, this or that? And of course, I can't know what's best for any person, but a response that I think was helpful was, well, because if there's a decision to be made, do I send them to hospice? Do I keep them at home? Is if you can project yourself into the future and look back on your decision you made, which decision do you think you would have the most peace with? And also just being with grief. I learned that grief is both beautiful and painful, of course, but beautiful also, because it's a reflection. The grief is a reflection of the love and the connection that was enjoyed before. I mean, the love doesn't go away and the connection changes. But I really learned in that situation that something can be painful and right at the same time. And I'm really grateful for that insight. So most recently, my current job is working in long-term care. I happened to stumble into the beginning of the COVID pandemic in Calgary. There was one long-term care that was had a huge number positive residents, and I was at that point working with an agency, and they just sent me in there, had no idea what I was walking into, but I happened to walk into that into that situation. So there was like, I don't know, 60 people on the floor. Almost all of them had COVID. The floor was, you know, it was kind of segregated from the rest of the building. We were all learning as we went. Everything was new. And I don't know how to, because the threat is invisible, it's really hard, impossible to know how to feel, which is an interesting position to be in, not knowing how to feel. You can go to fear, like during labor, or just back to the present, where everything for me personally, right, behind my mask and my visor and my blue isolation gown, I'm safe. I'm not sick now, right? To come back to that, to the possibility of getting sick with COVID and dying, which is what we all thought might happen, to the reality of the moment where right now I'm okay and I have a job to do. And you get used to it. And you get a sense of responsibility. At that point, we weren't allowed to go anywhere but work and home. We weren't allowed to go shopping or anything on our off time. We had to actually sign a piece of paper that says we couldn't do anything but go to work and go home. And we had this whole protocol about my husband would put a garbage bag at the back door, and I would strip at the back door and put all my clothes in the garbage bag, and the shower was downstairs, so then I'd throw my clothes in the washing machine, which is next to the shower, and I would jump in the shower and scrub myself head to toe, and then I'd head out my room, because we had no idea how contagious it was or how easily we would spread things. And reflecting now on, so I've lived the whole trajectory. My mother-in-law, with whom I live in the same house, just recovered from COVID in my home. and things are pretty quite opened up now. I just went out for dinner with my husband last night. We didn't have to wear masks, no social distancing, nothing. How we went from being quite scared and very careful and with a lot of not knowing and taking a lot of precautions to now where it all feels a lot different, a lot more open, not as scary, even though there's still lots of COVID around. So I worked all the waves in various facilities. And it saw lots of people die. But they were all old people. And it's interesting that although they died, it doesn't, the dying didn't seem like such a tragedy. I mean, the numbers were impressive, but of course, for each person, it's a journey. Dying is not pretty. At least the dying I've seen is never pretty. Death looks okay. Death looks kind of peaceful. It really kind of doesn't, that death itself doesn't scare me, but the dying, yeah, that's not so pretty. It's hard. And what was most tragic about the COVID dyings was they had to do it alone, right? Many of the people were already kind of alone out of their own dementia, but family wasn't allowed in. So, and although we tried, the staffs tried really hard to be there for everybody. Of course, we have a million things to do. So, and that dying alone, that kind of leaves an echo of sadness. Yeah. And so now we're on the other end, and I'm doing regular long-term care, which has its own interesting challenges, especially dealing with behaviors. So people with dementia often have, I mean, their personalities change and they don't react or act in ways that we would like, or logically, or with any kind of, along any kind of sort of norms. And so there's really a lot of opportunity for well, for instance, there's this one fellow who looks like a biker. He's a big guy, kind of scary maybe, and he gets verbally aggressive. I've never seen him physically aggressive, but he's verbally aggressive and kind of obstreperous. He likes to go against the flow. Lots of four-letter words and kind of explosive. And people in general are kind of afraid of him. But I have learned through practice to sort of get out of the way again. I think that's kind of the theme for me that I've learned from parenting and nursing, to get out of the way and try to see him, get past his anger to his hurtness. I know part of his story, there is lots of trauma. And of course his brain's not working properly anymore. And to speak to his need for connection, like Richard Kawagumi said, and the commonality in what makes a person feel loved and seen. I like, I really kind of think that to sort of see the child or the value in the person, to get past their behavior, and to same with watching old people. I mean, old people aren't pretty, right? And especially old sick people. There's lots of ways in which you can have aversion come up. But to really get out of the way, it's not about me, and see their humanity, and that they're, despite, you know, their brain's not working properly anymore, they really still want to be seen and loved and valued, and to try and get there, I think is a constant teacher for me to go there. And so I wrote a poem in response to one of these interactions with this fellow who got quite angry. I call it You and Me. Your anger, my withdrawal. Your hurt needing power, my fear needing safety. You wanting to be valued, me wanting to be valued. You see me, see you. I see you, see me. A sun rises. The other thing I love about my work is working with a team. So there's Yeah, healthcare aides, they do all the grungy work. The LPNs, they mostly give the medications and they're awesome. They always show up to work like mad. And the RNs who kind of talk to doctors and family and do more complex assessments and decide whether or not, you know, more care needs to be called in and the referrals need to be done and wound care. It's a beautiful thing when that team works. Again, it's about valuing each other, respecting each other, not being paternalistic, working with, and again, I noticed that the obstacle to working as a team is my self-centeredness. So for me, the theme of practice really is, and I've learned this through parenting and caregiving, is that it's not about me. To this oneness that Richard talks about is about getting out of the way of me and really living life from a point of view of us, but us all inclusive, not which includes taking care of myself, but also taking care of others and everything, earth, universe, and living in an intimate relationship with what is. I'm so grateful that my livelihood is so rich with opportunities to practice and live that. Thank you for listening. I hope there was something helpful in there. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Ku and Maria, for sharing so wholeheartedly with all of us about your life and work. Maybe I'll pass it over to someone else to field questions. Michael or Kay, can you do that? If the people have some questions they'd like to ask.
Okay, so Carrie, you had your hand up. Go ahead. Carrie, can you hear him?
Hi, are you calling on me? Okay. You are at a very different volume, so I needed to switch around. Thank you. Thank you for your talk, and I'm also a parent, and I wondered of a newly launched adult person, and I wondered if you could speak to the balance between getting out of the way, which I really appreciate that, but then also if you see something concerning, you know, how do you step in, step out? I would love to just hear your thoughts about that. Thank you.
I have lots of practice in that realm. One of my kids has had some issues with substance use. And I think the core intention for me that seems to work is, is the question, am I acting out of my own self-interest, or am I really, really, am I really coming from a point or from the intention of what is absolutely best for them? And I know that the fear of something bad happening to my child is a mixture of the pain I would feel if this bad thing happened with pure concern for their well-being. And so being super cognizant of where my fear, well, you know, what, where my fear is, where the motivation to act from my fear is acting. And also to be very patient that there's, even though, you know, you'd really like to just yank them out of the situation, segregate them in the room, keep them protected from all harm, that there's a process, to have patience and trust in the process, and that the thing, the most healing, I think, I think the most healing influence I can have as a parent of an adult person is to love them unconditionally, to not make their problem about me. That if, and that even though they're going to make choices that are going to put them at risk, my support for them and my belief in them and my respect for them is going to be more healing than me trying to heavy-handedly, paternalistically make decisions for them. I hope that answered it.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Anyone here? Like,
oh, no,
I'm
just...
no. Okay, Mo. Yeah. We have a question here. Go ahead, Mo.
She mentioned speech. Thank you for the talk. And you mentioned something about death being peaceful, dying not so much. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate more on that.
Yeah. So generally the people that I've seen die, right, are either super old people with dementia and multiple comorbidities. And for them, I mean, the process of dying and or younger people, perhaps with, you know, long-term, like severe illnesses, like cancer mostly. And the body breaking down towards death in both those situations. There's kind of like labor in the liver. There is kind of a rhythm to it that you start to see when you've seen a few. And it's the body slowly shutting down, right? Or sometimes quickly. And from the onlooker's point of view, doesn't look so great, right? You become bedbound. You need to be looked after for very basic needs. You stop wanting to eat and drink. The breathing becomes difficult. There might be pain involved. It's the last few steps on a journey that they've been part of, you know, of losing everything, of having to say goodbye to everything. So there's a lot of loss, there's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of pain. And so often death itself seems like a relief. If that makes any sense.
Thank you. Another question? Yeah. Oh, okay. I have a question from Claire. Claire, go ahead.
Hi, Maria. Thank you so much for your talk. It's really valuable and really heartfelt. Lots of wisdom there, lots of experience. And just to go back to the previous question around children and what you said about being aware of how much your fear of the pain that you'll experience if something bad happens to them. I find that really helpful. I've got a similar situation. And I'm just wondering what you find helpful to separate out that fear and to deal with your own fear without projecting it or acting on it.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a definitive technique to that at all, other than to be really, really super present. Bring all your zazen skills to bear on the moment before you act, right? Like if you're not sure, if I'm not sure if I'm saying this thing because I'm protecting myself or because it's going to be helpful in the long term for them, then maybe I just won't say it or do it. But yeah, no, it's, there's no, and sometimes you get it wrong, right? But that's where that whole mindfulness thing is super key. And I think you can still be fearful, but decide on an action that doesn't come from that fear. These very, like, the fear is over here and my decision is over here. But yeah, just keep it really close. Keep it really front and center.
Thank you.
Okay, one more question from here, Quintus, and then I'll check the Zoom people. Quintus, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for your talk. I was just wondering, in a field that you see so much suffering and so much pain, people, did you ever find yourself needing to show yourself involved in some way to protect yourself from other people's pain, or did you find it easy to identify with the pain that you see?
None of these people are people I had any connection with before, right? They're not my family. They're not my friend. Although I did have, in my 20s, my boyfriend died of a cancer. No, I don't take it in. No, I don't. But I'm not sure how it would feel to lose. I haven't lost a parent yet. I haven't lost any children. I can't imagine even just thinking about it, losing a child. I think that would be incredibly painful. But to watch patients, no, it's, I guess I've come to a place where it's kind of normal. Not ordinary, or maybe it is, but not, and not to diminish it, right, in that way, but it is, it's part of being. Yeah, but I guess the bottom line is it's not really my loss, so it's not my pain. Yeah,
thank you. I think we had two questions. Jacob, do you want to go first? And then Michelle, you had a question too, right? So Jacob and then Michelle.
Hi, Maria. Similar to Quintus's question, maybe this might be different than I was envisioning, having heard your answer to his question. You know, when I was doing therapy in Fort McMurray, I found to really kind of like put myself to the side and be really available to someone, really bear witness to pain, and to do that really frequently. To recover from that and sustain that was something I found quite challenging. And, you know, thinking about people who've been working frontline and long-term care, I can't help but imagine that would be very demanding in these qualities of being able to recover from, you know, bearing witness to suffering and recovering from that, giving yourself fully to somebody, then having to come back to yourself. And I'm wondering if you have anything to share in terms of, did you learn what works for you in terms of how to come back from that, giving yourself fully to somebody, and come back from bearing witness to pain, to come back into your own life, your own body, and to recover from those difficult days that surely would have happened along the way?
I think one difference maybe for a nurse working in a team versus a therapist is that I'm not alone ever, right? I can diffuse the stress with my colleagues. I think that's one really key thing. Also, I have a very supportive family. So it gets diffused there, but I also don't, and then another aspect is that I don't really feel like I'm putting myself aside. I think it's more like, I'm putting my self-centered agenda aside. So if I don't, if my resident says, no, I don't want my insulin, and I've got, you know, I'm on the clock, I got 45 other residents, and this guy needs to have his insulin, I'm going to get stressed if it's about my agenda. If I can see it as his choice, right? Maybe I'll come back and see if he wants to make another choice later, but not making it about me and my agenda, then there's really no putting me aside and no me to come back to, really. I don't know if that kind of, I mean, that's sort of it's a task, and it's easier sort of to identify as an agenda item, right? Versus being more like more soft skill type stuff, like, I don't know, addressing your emotional trauma or whatever, and putting myself aside for that. Maybe it works the same way. But I do think that if I'm carrying around my own trauma, unresolved trauma, and that's triggered by an interaction, that you're just going to suffer. And there's maybe no putting that aside. And, you know, I think that then the work there is just to do the work of overcoming or dealing with your own trauma. I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah.
Michelle, do you want to ask the last question, and then it'll be time for us to have service.
I think in many ways the questions have been, my questions have been answered, but maybe I'll morph it. It's so I've also spent time around death, dying and grieving families, sometimes like on a palliative care unit, room to room to room sort of. And I'm just curious, you know, do you have any kind of rituals or touchstones if you're going from one family to a next family to a next, so you're not carrying what was with one to the next, do you have any sort of little rituals you do in between, or, you know, when you talk about putting yourself aside, how do you do that?
I don't really think I put myself aside. I don't know. Because honestly, when I walk out the door of a person's house, I'm done. Unless something got triggered in me that I need to deal with, I am done with that situation. I don't think... it's not like I'm compartmentalizing myself out of the situation. That's not what I'm doing. Like the guy on the insulin, I'm just letting go of my agenda. So if I'm walking out of one patient's room and I think, well, I haven't lived up to my own expectation of what I meant to accomplish there, or they don't look as happy as the goal of, you know, or whatever, then maybe you walk out of the room unsatisfied and you still need to process it. I don't know. But if I feel like I've been present and been able to wholeheartedly meet, according to my abilities, of course, meet the needs of the situation, then there's no, I'm not carrying anything out of that room. No.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think what we do need to close now so we can have time for service. Maria, thank you so much for sharing this aspect of your life with us. It's given us, I think, a lot to think about as we have service and go on through our week. Kate, did you want to add anything?
Just a big, deep bow from all of us. Let's all bow to Maria.
Stop.